ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
I mean, why didn't they just use Harry Holt's high school nickname, Puss? These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
Search The Dead Can't Sue podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party: change or die.
The public are sick and tired of being ignored.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation here in Sydney. And PK, the big political moment this week here was the PM speech on AI, I think. It was long awaited, much talked up. What did you think?
I thought it was quite a pivotal moment for the government. AI has been one of these burning issues for a long time, in the last couple of years. But this was the Prime Minister standing up and finally leading an agenda on what they will do on AI. And that's, I think, significant. I still think there are details that I can't wait to mine the brain of our next guest on, because there are some vagaries that I'm a little confused about, but I think the broad parameters show that the government has read the very noisy room. And the noisy room I'm referring to is that the public is worried about AI and they know that they have to provide some markers of what we think is acceptable. He went further than some expected, but as I say, Fran, some of the details still needs to be, I think, coloured in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right about reading the room. There's been plenty of reaction. Surprisingly, the AI giants were some of the first out of the box, at pains, really, to frame their responses positively. Google and OpenAI both describing the PM speech as constructive and promising to engage constructively, which is, you know, what you could hope for, I guess. But as you say, there's a lot of detail be filled in. So there's still plenty of wriggle room. It's going to have its critics. People are going to be watching closely. The big thing here, and we'll get into this with our guests, is the PM says Australia will legislate national frameworks, and we're going to get that early next year. So that's where the rubber hits the road, really. But PK, also a huge story, obviously, globally this week. The US-Iran war has kicked off again. We had tolls and no tolls threatened by the US president. I don't know how the Albanese government can really deal with this erratic American president. This could have implications, of course, for so many things, including the price of fuel, but that affects so many things, obviously. So there's that. And there's also a lot going on in the One Nation front this week, including
One Nation, or is it White Lotus front?
Ah, ha, 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 boom, boom. You can explain that. Angus Taylor, anyway, finally weighing in and sort of getting tough, muscling up a bit to Pauline Hanson. I'm interested to talk to you and our guest a bit more about what that means.
So let's bring him in. Ronald Mizen. Ron Mizen is political correspondent with the Australian Financial Review, and he's been putting all his energy into reporting on AI. And I wonder how much he's used AI in his reporting of AI. Ron, welcome.
G'day, Fran. PK, good to be with you.
I'm serious. That was a real question. How much do you use AI in reporting on AI?
It's a good question. Look, Nine, my employer, is pretty strong in embracing AI within certain limits. You know, we're not allowed to have paragraphs written by AI, but, you know, we do use it for things like headline ideas and structuring ideas and a bit of research. So it's like with every industry, I think we're grappling with how we implement it in a way that's ethical and responsible, and in a way that we don't sort of do ourselves out of the job in the long term.
Yeah, and I wonder if you're going to find that it's a bit of a creeping use. You start with a pretty simple thing like that, and then this becomes more convenient, this becomes more convenient. I guess that's where we need guardrails. Speaking of which, the Prime Minister's speech yesterday at Sydney Uni was the talk of the town. He did lay out a roadmap for Australia's AI future, Ron.
Today I announce that to seize and shape and share the generational opportunity that AI represents, our government will establish a set of Australian standards for AI. In March this year, we announced a set of expectations for large AI data centres. This will bring them into one regulatory framework, clear, consistent, and mandatory.
Ron, it did seem like a change of tune. This government had been talking about a light-touch regulatory regime, more hands-off, but yesterday the Prime Minister was promising to not just regulate but to legislate a set of national standards around the contentious issues, energy use, water use, maintaining copyright laws to protect our creative industries, to make sure nothing that gets used without their permission and compensation. There's still not a lot of detail, but these national legislated AI standards, Ron, what brought this about face, and do you see it actually as an about face?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the Prime Minister has clearly read the political tea leaves and decided that he needs to take a clear and active, leadership of the issue. And it's, you know, as he said, it touches across every aspect of the government. Every minister is dealing with this. Every business is dealing with this. Every cultural institution is dealing with this. And so, you know, he's clearly decided that he wants to make very plain what the government's approach is going to be. It absolutely is a backflip. I mean, in the last term of Parliament, Ed Husic is Industry Minister was working on legislated guide rails for artificial intelligence. Now, they didn't come into effect. After the election, of course, new ministers who decided to take a far more hands-off approach, they saw the benefit of AI across the economy, particularly with our productivity being so woeful at the moment. A year later, a big about face on that. We're now talking about taking data center guidelines that were announced earlier this year and AI guidelines announced last year that were not law. They were sort of like best case scenario, please do this, and making it very clear that, this is how we expect you to behave. But the devil is in the detail, as PK said earlier. And, you know, the important line, particularly around data centres, was the Prime Minister said, new generation large data centres. Now, the details of what that means still need to be worked out. That doesn't mean every data centre.
We'll create a legal obligation for the next generation of large-scale data centres to underwrite new power supply, to pay their full share of grid connection so no costs are passed on to homes or businesses.
And I suspect that's going to be a bit of a point of contention over the coming months.
And Ron, do you agree with PK that this about face was the government, the Prime Minister in particular, reading the room, really, reading the national sentiment?
Yeah, absolutely. And the speech yesterday had a little bit for everybody, a little bit for the creative sector. It had a little bit there for the AI and data centres. I mean, Albanese wasn't shying away from AI. He was saying that Australia wants to be a world leader. We want to build AI here, train it here. We want to incorporate it. But, you know, as he said, we want to do it safely within the rules in a way that doesn't ensure that people lose jobs, in a way that protects people's privacy. It was a really fascinating speech in the sense that a lot of time and effort had clearly gone into this. And I think every single group that cares probably took away something to feel positive about.
I think that's right, Ron. I'm really interested in the point you made about how it's a big change because out of everything that's been covered in the last day, I don't feel like there's been enough emphasis on just what a significant change in direction this is. And I've got a couple of examples. Yes, Ed Husic pushing for the AI Act and the government essentially repudiating that approach. The other part is the Productivity Commission, remember, coming out and saying, don't regulate AI, that they had those round tables where they discussed productivity. The Treasurer, everyone else in the kind of realm of the economic portfolios, pushing against regulation on the basis that it would stifle economic growth. And this is different. I just think that the difference is actually quite significant and not enough has been made of it. What do you think?
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, that obviously implies a lot of people, and I don't assume that all your listeners have necessarily followed this as closely in the intricate details over the past 2 years as we might have, but I mean, it is a substantive shift in position on a whole bunch of areas. I mean, I think the key thing is, though, there's still 6 to 12 months before we see legislation, and it will be really interesting to see how that legislation actually forms, because, you know, the copyright element is still unresolved. The Prime Minister's made very clear, of course, that rights holders must be paid and they must choose. But he's not saying no change. You know, he has left open the prospect that there could be changes to copyright. And in particular, my understanding is that that's about dealing with the, you know, thousands of rights holders that might own a website or one book or a Substack who aren't already represented by a rights holder organisation. You know, how do you deal with them? That's thousands of organisations. So it's going to be interesting to see how that goes.
It's definitely difficult, though, isn't it? I mean, he made the point that no country's got this right yet, and we're working on it. So he's not just saying, as you said, we're just going to leave our laws as it is, there'll be no change, and they've just got to cop it. He's kind of indicating they're working on trying to get a better solution that doesn't shut down what AI, the elements AI needs to develop, particularly an Australian relevant, culturally relevant large language model, you know, option for Australia, but just making sure our creatives will have a say in it and get a fair cop.
Yeah, and you know, Attorney General Michelle Rowland is leading the charge on this, and it's going to be interesting to see how she goes. You know, Michelle Rowland has had some stumbles over the past couple of years in terms of getting stakeholders on board. You know, the mis and disinformation laws are a good example of that. And so she has a really big task of bringing together everybody in a way that's not going to get the government in trouble, particularly with the creative sector, when they finally outline the position they land on.
Okay, so let's go to some of the detail. We talk about detail. Ron, I reckon yesterday, and we're recording this on a Thursday, so the PM gives his speech, then when there were a range of interviews. I interviewed, for instance, Tim Ayres, who is the industry minister, and I was a bit confused by his answers, I've got to say, about what the legislation would include. He seemed to suggest that it was very much centred around data centres and the rules around how they are allowed to get approvals and so forth, you know, energy, water. Is it just going to be confined to that? Have we got clarity on that?
I think in the first instance, it's taking the existing data center framework that was announced earlier this year and making it law. But then there is the ability here to tack on other things. You know, the National Conference for Labor is next week in Adelaide. There is a big new element being added into the national platform of labor around artificial intelligence. You know, clearly for the union movement and the labor base, this is a big issue. And I thought what was notable is one of the additions to that was that if there is large scale job losses, if the economy starts to suffer as a result of AI, then the government will take an interventionist and active approach in the economy. Now, that's a pretty interesting statement there, because that would be effectively what the unions were asking for. They're not asking for it now, but that would be some of them certainly want it, which is the government stepping in around the workplace relations aspect of AI. And of course, by creating this legislation, you've then got the ability, or you've got a framework in which to add on other laws. So, you know, I think if you start with the basis that data centres, those electricity requirements, the water requirements are the first instance, but it could become bigger and more thorough, or sort of more encompassing rather, as time goes on.
In a way, the data centres is an easier thing to do because it's a distinct thing. Once you're talking about jobs, you know, the union demands, the union secretary Sally McManus has welcomed this framework, but, you know, it's hard to work out, I think, how much a government can dictate about training and skills and all of that. I spoke to a pretty interesting guest, I have to say, a woman called Johanna Weaver from the Tech Policy Design Institute. I spoke to her on the Radio National Hour last night. It's an independent think tank. It's been consulting a lot with the government. She backed the idea of the AI office. She backed the fact that this was largely about data centres, but they've also done a big lot of work on skills and training and inclusivity, which is interesting. But I want to talk to you about the coalition's response, because opposition leader Angus Taylor went out early. He went out on the idea of the, you know, the AI office and just dismissed it.
And just to explain, the AI office is this new office in the Prime Minister's department to basically oversee the whole sort of strategy, yeah?
That's right. And Angus Taylor said, look, it's just another bureaucracy. What's that going to do?
What he's announced is an office in an office, inside his own office. He's going to have another office. And what is that office going to do? I mean, honestly, the answer to this is not more bureaucracy. The trouble with this Prime Minister and this government is the answer to every problem is always more bureaucracy.
Ron, is that a helpful criticism from the opposition leader? I can't see that he's had a lot to say yet about the substance of the speech we actually got and the idea of legislating these national frameworks, but are there risks for the opposition pushing back on this? Are they wise to just let it play out a bit? What do you think of their contribution so far?
He probably went out a little bit early, really. I mean, he was responding to an extract of the speech that was given to the media the day before the speech. So, you know, he hadn't seen the full suite and he was responding to a small part of it. His instinct, of course, was to go on the attack over the idea of more bureaucracy. You know, it's small government, big government is a big part of the current political debate between the two major parties there. So, you know, it will be interesting to see how the response to the government's AI speech yesterday evolves, because I think they're not silly on this stuff either. I think they recognise that there is political risk in this, particularly around the data centres. They want to see the economic benefits, but even we saw Jane Hume hedging a little bit yesterday and suggesting that there needed to be a framework in which everyone needs to operate and do the right thing. So no
doubt.
The
framework, that's what, I mean, that's where the wriggle room is, right? It's a framework that all the PMs said, for instance, the big sort of pinch points, energy use, water use, jobs. On energy use, the PM said they're going to legislate to make sure that the new data centres, the next generation of large-scale data centres, underwrite new power supply. The implication is, and all the signs are, it needs to be renewable energy as much as possible. But, you know, the word underwrite means, as I understand, what they're doing anyway right now, which is they don't have to build and provide their distinct new energy supply themselves. They just need to make sure that they're buying that enough power from renewable energy sources to provide what they need. Now, any of us can do that at the moment. It's not suggesting that they have to build their own standalone solar stations, I don't think, for instance. But also with water concerns, I mean, Sydney Water is pretty clear. It says these new huge data centres could consume up to 25% of Sydney's water in the next decade. But all the PM has said so far is, you know, they need to have efficient water use. There's a lot of wriggle room there in that term, efficient water use, isn't there?
Well, the problem that the PM has is that a lot of this is out of the control of the federal government. You know, he made clear yesterday that he needs to go and sort of talk to the states and territory premiers and chief ministers to try and come to a agreed, you know, rules on this, because a lot of it will be implemented at the state level. And the other complication is that a lot of these states are competing to attract this investment.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got this idea of Queensland, for example, turning around and saying to data centre operators, come to Queensland, build a gas power plant, you know, or power by gas. We're not fussed whether it's renewables. So, you know, there is a lot of, I think, you know, Anthony Albanese came out as the nation's leader to say, this is the way in which I think we need to go. But a lot of this is beyond his control, and he will be dealing with states who some of which I actually think they'll want to go harder. They'll want to extract more from these data centres, while others will be, you know, more willing to let it rip. And there's not really a great deal that the federal government can do to stop that competition.
No, and the competition is all about dollar bills, right? Like, that's what it's about. But if you look at the reaction to these data centres around the world, the real-time protests going on and the political discourse around, you know, them being in people's backyards. So we've got the Greens. I want to talk about the political dimensions here. The Greens have been all over this. They're calling for a moratorium on them. They've been, you know, campaigning at that sort of local level against them in areas where people have been really angry about them being in their backyards.
Well, New York, the state of New York, has just put in place a moratorium because they can see how dangerous these data centres are marching through the state of New York. And it's not just the Greens who are calling for a moratorium. I think if you tested the pulse of Australians, any community that's having a data centre imposed upon it, the sense I get when I'm out talking to Australians is they desperately also want a moratorium, because they're asking, well, what's in it for them?
And then we even had the One Nation leader, Pauline Hanson, mention it in her National Press Club speech, Ron. So you know, when we talked about reading the room earlier, it's actually just getting ahead of what could be a political, I don't want to swear, but you know what I'm thinking, for governments. So it's actually in their interests, isn't it, to try and manage this, because when people get cranky about these things, it's ugly.
Oh, absolutely. And we're sort of seeing that play out around the country with certain data center developments where communities are really pushing back. Local governments are finding, you know, really significant pushback where they even have control. A lot of this is obviously is sometimes punted up to state planning groups to give control. And Victoria is a prime example of that. You know, they spent quite a few years basically opening the door to data centers and saying, we're open for business, come here. And they're now finding that a lot of people are very unhappy with that approach, that some of the data center operators have, you know, I don't know whether I can say it on your podcast, but taken the piss a little bit. And they're now, you know, they're now paying the price for that. Mm. Equally, there's the balance. It's that economic benefit. But as the Prime Minister said yesterday, though, once these data centers are built, there's not many people that are employed in them. Mm. So you've also got this element of people, I think, realizing, yes, this, you know, Anthropic coming in and saying that it'll spend $15 billion on data center investment and AI investment. You've got Microsoft saying, you know, more than $20 billion. But what does that actually mean in terms of long-term job prospects? And I think there's a lot of people that are thinking, well, it's all very well and good, but where does that leave me at the end of the day? And sort of, we're talking a lot about the politics of this, but I think one of the other fascinating dimensions of this is just purely the cultural dimension. And we're now having conversations about, you know, what it means to value human work and human creativity. I mean, the former chief scientist, Alan Finkel, is now on this drive to basically, you know, label human work rather than labeling AI work and sort of provide a value and a above and beyond on what it means to be human. And I think that's a really fascinating cultural conversation that we're going to be having for a long time, particularly is that some of the AI becomes almost as intelligent as human.
I think it's a cultural conversation that the government's not even halfway ready for yet, and it's time to be, because things are getting ahead of us. And in a shameless pitch for my own program, the Radio National Hour, we've been doing some great work on this, talking to some really interesting people who have been way ahead in the thinking on this. So, you know, if you're interested in it, I would recommend you go and listen to some of these people. But, you know, just on that thing of the national framework, this is the government trying to say to the states that you can't just auction off standards here. We got to get ahead of this, or it's going to get, you know, out of our hands. But look, it's not all AI this week, Ron. We saw an almost, on a huge story that has implications for the whole world, another one. We saw an almost full-scale renewal of the US-Iran conflict this week. Iran declared the Strait of Hormuz closed. Ships have been damaged and sunk. People have been killed in this crossfire now. Donald Trump said the US was going to impose tolls. Then he took tolls off the table 12 hours later. I don't know how you deal with a president who operates like this. Overnight, more strikes, a fresh round of strikes from the US. The president is talking about plans for ground troops and says bridges and nuclear facilities will be targeted if Iran doesn't return to negotiations. So for now, the ceasefire seems to be over. Interestingly, overnight, the Iranian Speaker of the Parliament made some comments saying that Iran must always be prepared for war, but at the same time, we must use the tools of diplomacy and negotiation to achieve national interests. So I think there's bridges being built back to trying to get this ceasefire back in place. Our government here, Ron, seems to be waiting it out, seeing where it lands before it can really work out which response to make. But, you know, realistically, we don't have much power to affect anything here. So that feels like the safest approach, would you say? How do you think the Albanese government's handling this?
I think a lot of what they've done in response to this was really done a few months ago. You know, the key issues for us out of this conflict are that oil supply, the supply of fertilizers, and sort of other critical things like bitumen, for example, inputs into that, you know, things that go into roads. A lot of that comes from that part of the world and is being affected by this. The government knew that. They saw the possible really big downside scenarios earlier this year when the conflict first kicked off, and have been scrambling to try and build build up our reserves in all of those different areas and try and build those international relationships to ensure the existing supplies that we have don't get cut off. But look, I wouldn't be surprised if Treasurer Jim Chalmers has a little widget on his phone that kind of just tracks the oil price, because that's a pretty good indicator.
He should have a widget on his phone to track the oil price, shouldn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I had a just sort of looked through the papers this morning, and I sort of had one analyst suggesting that we could see the oil price jump up to $120 a barrel, which, you know, would be pretty bad for inflation. Equally, there was another analyst who's sort of taking a more long-term approach, suggesting that this is going to see a glut of oil eventually, and the price is going to slump down to $60 a barrel. Now, that's a pretty significant divergence in where things might land. And all of that at the end of the day simply hits people, you know, in the hip pockets at the Bowser. But look, one of the really fascinating elements I think about this is that this conflict has just really changed how we're thinking Australia about that transition from fossil fuels.
Oh,
you know, we're
time.
Seeing potentially 500,000 batteries installed this year.
It's incredible. 1,000 a day in Australia.
It's incredible. And also the largest uptake of electric vehicles.
Oh, the electric vehicles thing, even anecdotally, right? Like, beyond the figures tell the story, but, you know, any social group you're in, everyone used to be a very middle to upper class conversation. Now you're seeing them in the outer suburbs. You know, you're seeing it.
Because they're getting cheaper too, right?
Correct. And part of that is, you know, we've got cars available. We're not going to talk brands right now, but, you know, cheaper cars available in our country that are maybe manufactured in a country called China that are very accessible.
China's dominating.
Right, Ron? Like, this is the reason.
Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't it?
I mean, BYD is going through the roof in terms of, you know, sorry, we're not supposed to talk brands, my bad.
But that's what I was referring to.
We saw this amazing thing happen. They built a carrier to bring over 5,000 EVs to Australia. We've never seen something like that before.
I mean, earlier this year, they were using an old showground to warehouse cars because they knew the demand was going to be coming. I mean, it's a really fascinating response. But also, again, come back to the cultural element. I think there's been this shift where, you know, we were having this conversation about range anxiety and would the batteries deteriorate, et cetera. But now you're having, you know, conversations at barbecues where somebody who might have been a little bit skeptical is all of a sudden talking to their friend and their other friend, oh, they've got the electric car. I mean, I think I'm not going to name them on this show, but I can think about someone very clear in my mind who, you know, might work in the same office as me, who was, you know, he had the big four-wheel drive, the big ice, you know, the big, I'm not going to mention the brand, but the big four-wheel drive, the big gas
guzzler.
Don't
mention the name or the brand, okay?
I won't. And you know, like, he's really shifted over the past 12 months and he's thinking on this, and he's now got an electric car.
Wow.
And so I think that's a really good example of what's also happening culturally. You know, people are seeing that their friends and their colleagues have got the electric car. They're not, you know, the disruption's not too bad. If you're going on a longer holiday, yeah, you've got to plan a little bit. But, you know, at the end of the day, you plug it in at night, you charge it overnight, and that's as difficult as it gets.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so I'm going to do a very dramatic pivot to another conversation we've been having this week. It's the midwinter break. So as tradition has it, people, politicians, but also other people, people with a bit of money in their pockets. A lot of people at the moment don't have money in their pockets, but those who do are flocking to Europe. And that includes One Nation leader Pauline Hanson, who has been in the UK meeting with a very controversial figure, and today Barnaby Joyce has had to defend her for meeting Tommy Robinson, now reportedly spotted thanks to some Australians who are at a resort and not afraid to post on their Instagram about two icons, Gina Rinehart and Pauline Hanson, who are at an Italian resort in Sicily. Hanson has styled herself as the anti-politician, sort of working-class hero. But this, the optics of this, I'm not sure will help her with that. And oh my goodness, there's one thing I have learnt from my own travels. Australians are everywhere. You cannot go anywhere without being snapped by an Australian. So if you go to a resort, Pauline Hanson, there will be an Aussie with a phone. Am I right, Ron?
Especially around the pool, right?
Oh, I love a pool too.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you know, both Gina Rinehart and Pauline Hanson are, as I think the phrase you used, were iconic. You know, they stand out. We
know what they look like.
Exactly. It's very hard to go incognito when you're Pauline Hanson. And so, yes, these photos that have appeared on Instagram with some fantastic captioning, by the way. Kudos to whoever took the photos and added, you know, the captions over the top of them. I think we can all relate. But yeah, I mean, it's a really fascinating. I mean, of course, this comes after. The reason that Pauline Hanson is in the UK is because she's meeting, as you say, with these controversial figures. But she's also going to be talking at the CPAC conference later this month. That's the Conservative Global Movement Conference. Now, the last time that Pauline Hanson spoke at that was at Mar-a-Lago, where she did get a lift on Gina Rinehart's jet over to the US. So I wonder whether, you know, maybe she got a lift to the resort this time around. Maybe it's a question for when she comes back to Australia.
Well, Gina Rinehart's one thing, but what about Pauline Hanson going there and hanging out with Holly Valance, ex-Neighbours star turned far-right, very high-profile, Restore UK MP Rupert Lowe, who left Reform because he was too far-right for Nigel Farage, which says a lot, and Tommy Robinson, far-right agitator, convicted criminal with a rap sheet quite long. He's an unabashed anti-Islamist. Even Piers Morgan has condemned Tommy Robinson as a thug. What? Why? My question is why? Why is Pauline Hanson hanging out with this slice of the UK in such a high-profile way, Ron?
I mean, that's obviously a question she's got to answer, but just from an observer's perspective, I think it's because she feels an affinity with their politics and with the things that they believe in and have been sort of fighting for over the years. Now,
well, she might, but how many Australians do? Sure, it's red meat to the rusted-on fringe base of One Nation, but I'm just wondering how it'll play with all the recent converts. You know, long-time Liberal voters, a lot of them who've recently said they'll now support One Nation. I'm not so sure it'll play well.
I think that's the risk at the end of the day, right? Like, we know that the Trump-style politics of the US really did hurt Peter Dutton during the last election. Pauline Hanson has in some ways embraced that, but at the other times she sort of pulled back from that. So, you know, I think they're very wary of the fact that there is risks with this. But, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, there are a lot of people who would be supporting Pauline Hanson based on one or two policies who might then feel pretty uncomfortable with what they're seeing right now. And, you know, we did see some of the polling earlier this week show a slight decrease. I mean, One Nation is still doing very well in the polls, but certainly a pullback. And that came after the monocultural speech at the National Press Club, of course. So, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens among her supporter base as these images and as these meetings sort of flow through to the public consciousness and whether it makes people think twice about it. But, you know, it is a fascinating time to be over in the UK and doing podcasts with controversial people. I think it keeps us in news.
It definitely keeps us busy, but I just think the Europe trip for Pauline Hanson is definitely a high risk, low reward, because in terms of the people she's mixing with and the things she's talking about, she's already got those voters. So she doesn't grow her vote by doing this. She you know, maybe embeds her vote, but it's there anyway. If people who are concerned about Islamic migration, they're already largely voting for her. I don't think they're then seeing her talk to Tommy Robinson and thinking, oh, okay, now I'm voting for her, right? So she's got them. She doesn't grow a new vote in the centre, which she had been growing. And then the optics of her with Gina Rinehart at this fancy White Lotus, that's the White Lotus reference at the start of the pod, guys, here it comes delivered to you now. You know, this kind of, if you've watched that show, it's this sort of fancy pants lifestyle in
Europe.
I think
it's this very resort, isn't it?
I don't know if it's, is it? Maybe. I don't know. It's sort of detail I'm not across. I've not been there. I would like to go.
Might
I won't
be wrong.
Lie.
I haven't been there either, everyone's just saying.
But in terms of the optics, Ron, I don't think they're helpful to her, are they? It's not really working class hero shots, is it?
This is always the big challenge for parties that come from a political extreme or a political fringe, is that, you know, they have a base that supports them. That base is pretty well locked in. But to gain more power, to gain more influence in the parliament, you have to sort of broaden out who you're trying to attract into your fold. And, you know, that's clearly what Pauline Hanson has been able to achieve early this year. But then the question does become is in trying to really speak to that base, to throw it red meat, whether you risk some of those people that have come to you. And we see this both, I mean, I think we saw it in the Liberal Party. We've seen it, you know, in terms of that teal movement stripping away a lot of votes from the more progressive part of the Liberal Party. I think there's a risk here that you do absolutely see it in the One Nation. I mean, we don't just see it in political parties. We also see it in media organisations. I mean, those that have a particular demographic and audience, and then they try and expand it out, but often find that it's really difficult to both maintain that hardcore base that want to hear very certain things from you while not scaring away the other audiences that you're trying to attract.
Yeah, and while she's doing this, of course, One Nation Senator Malcolm Roberts has been revealed this week as being a supporter of some very high-profile conspiracy theorists, including, you know, and he's shared or played footsie with some of these conspiracies, you know, Holocaust denier, Sandy Hook School massacre denier. Now, you know, Malcolm Roberts has been revealed as supporting the chemtrails conspiracy theory. If you don't know these theories, look them up because they're discredited, they're extreme. So that's all happening while she's got the optics of her, you know, walking along with Tommy Robinson. At the same time, One Nation's other sort of jewel in the crown, Barnaby Joyce, he's their Treasury spokesperson. He's been back here trying to talk economy, but he's been sidetracked on Malcolm Roberts and on Pauline Hanson. And I thought, at least on RN Breakfast this morning, looking a little kind of awkward, sounding a little uncomfortable.
I first of all, I know about the tougher issues. I mean, we're talking about it now. We know about it. But, you know, and I want to be able to hear the person and try and work out, for better or for worse, why did this person get the prominence and get the support they did? What went wrong that happened?
But Ron, your colleagues at AFR have been looking at some of One Nation's policies and costing them. What have they found?
Yeah, and look, kudos to my colleague Michael Reid on this. He's done a really big deep dive, and he's really tailored it specifically just to One Nation's cost of living package. And he's estimated, both through parliamentary budget costings and other sort of official sources, that it's going to cost $90 billion over the next 4 years. And economists have kind of suggested that the claims that would be offset by savings elsewhere, like One Nation wants to abolish the Federal Education Department, wants to scrap climate change programs and withdraw Indigenous funding, that they will offset that amount, has drawn a bit of skepticism. And that's sort of even before we get to the commitments to increase defence spending to, you know, 5% of GDP, which is absolutely mammoth over the next 10 years. It's hundreds of billions of dollars in extra spending. And this is the risk, right? You know, it's when you're a minor party and you've got 6% of the vote, no one is really worried about, you know, interrogating your facts, because they don't think that you're going to be in a position to be able to implement in government. Equally, no one was that fussed about interrogating what Malcolm Roberts had to say, because they never thought he'd have his hands on the levers of power. But now, you know, things have changed. When you're ranking as the second most popular party in the polls, people want to take a closer look at, you know, who will be the people making decisions in the Treasury Department, who will be the people making decisions in, you know, the Attorney General's Department, et cetera. I mean, could you imagine Malcolm Roberts as Attorney General with, you know, if he believes some of these things that, you know, he's of the people he supports, that would draw a lot of worry for voters, I think. You know, today we saw him apparently saying, I was just reading a Sydney Morning Herald story, saying positive things about a very controversial mural that had to be removed in the UK, which had significant anti-Semitic tropes about it. So, you know, this is the risk of success, is that you've got to deal with some of this stuff that has been buried in history that hasn't bothered people to this point.
Yeah, it's such a good point about how things get missed when or not focused on. I mean, if you think about it, just because a lot of people ask questions of us as journalists, don't they, in terms of, you know, what we cover, what we don't. The truth is, you know, stories are like atoms. They're everywhere, right? You choose what you go to based on, you know, the power of the politician and all of that emphasis that you then provide. And now they're the real deal, apparently. So we are giving them the kind of coverage that you give a party of government, essentially, which is what they say that they could be. Look, I want to just go to what's been huge this week particularly, but of course, since the Bondi terror attack, we have been having a discussion about anti-Semitism, but also all of the evidence going before the Royal Commission. The Royal Commission into anti-Semitism and social cohesion has been looking at universities and the experience of Jewish students this week. Vice-Chancellors have been fronting to the Royal Commission to answer questions. University of Sydney Vice-Chancellor Mark Scott apologised for what was a light-touch approach to what was 2 months of pro-Palestinian campus encampments. It's a real balancing act, of course, for universities. I think it's very vexed. That doesn't mean that I don't think universities should be taking a very strong stand on anti-Semitism. But, of course, universities have been a hotbed of activism for a very long time. And so that's why I think vice-chancellors did struggle with how to allow freedom of students to be activists, but also they didn't get it right, I don't think. It's quite obvious in terms of protecting Jewish students and their right to study. Ron, just your view on this. I mean, universities really being held to account this week, but some difficult questions about how we define anti-Semitism, the definitions the government is imposing on universities or not imposing so they can make their own definitions essentially. Where are we getting to here?
I mean, it's really difficult from a government perspective because, of course, if they impose a definition of anti-Semitism, the IRA definition that they've adopted themselves, then, of course, there'll be criticism that the government is trying to intervene in academic freedom and integrity. Equally, by letting the universities, by basically saying the universities have to come up with a definition themselves, you know, you're facing criticism that you're not doing enough to respond to some of the, I mean, I think as Bill Shorten said, thuggery that we saw on campuses over the past few years. So I don't envy Jason Clare and the education minister in this case because you're going to find critics on both sides. But I think at the end of the day, the government has adopted that IRA definition. They seem to be comfortable. That definition comes with some examples of what is anti-Semitism that have proved a little bit controversial among some groups, but certainly the government has been comfortable with all of those. You know, the university is now incumbent on them to figure out, you know, well, I think to argue why they shouldn't adopt that standard. You know, it seems to be a standard that's willing to be adopted by government and by the opposition and by organisations all over the world. So, it's incumbent upon them to say, well, this is why, and then to defend it.
I mean, adopting a standard is one thing. Working out the balance of freedom of speech and the right to protest and anti-Semitism is another. And I think, you know, the Chancellor of Western Sydney Uni, Jennifer Westacott, was very strong on this in her submission to the Royal Commission. She basically was very critical of the other unis. She said she thought they hid behind free speech. And I think that that line that Bill Shorten drew was pretty good, which is, no academic freedom, says you can behave like a bully and a thug. I think the unis really were sort of weirdly caught on the hop on this. And I say weirdly because it had been happening in universities overseas and they really struggled to get it right. And I understand it's really difficult and complicated and feelings are high on all sides. But I think we nearly really need to work out that universities so that this can be a safe place for all without stifling, you know, freedom of speech and contest of ideas.
And Fran, we can get a little bit caught up, I think, in the legalistic nature of this. You know, I kind of put my my sort of law graduate hat on and thought about this definition and the ways that it might be interrogated. And yeah, of course, I think there are edge cases where you might say, well, if somebody said this or believed this, they might legitimately do so without it being anti-Semitic.
Agree,
but
absolutely.
At the end of the day, I think we kind of put a bit of sensibility into this. I think we know it when we see it. We can kind of tell, actually, you know what, you're not being genuine in that and you probably are saying that from a place that's not right versus, you know, I think someone might be saying something from a place that is positive and it might fall into one of those edge case definitions. So we just need to have a bit of, I think, practical common sense to this as well, and not get too far into that world of black and white law.
Yeah, and uni's relying on the police, and police saying one thing because they've got a criminal standard. It's tricky. Ron, you have been incredible. Before you go, I just want to let you know, give you an update on the Taormina resorts in Sicily. Turns out I'm a Google expert now. It was not, in fact, the White Lotus Resort. It was not the Four Seasons San Domenico Palace at Taormina, where Pauline Hanson was snapped poolside with Gina Reinhart. It was the Grand Hotel San Pietro in Taormina. So, just so you know.
Which one's better?
That I do not know.
I'd go to both.
Oh, you would? I would go to both.
I'd go to both.
I think we need a study.
I would go to both. I haven't been to either, just to be clear.
I think we need to do a party room live at both of the resorts and make a determination. Something that will never happen. Ron, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ron.
That's it for the Party Room today. We will be back for a Question Time edition tomorrow, but keep sending your questions in because, of course, we think your questions are fantastic. We especially like the voice notes so we can hear from you. You can email them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Yeah, there's nothing better than hearing from you all. And remember, David Lipson will be back with Insiders on Background on Saturday.
That's right. And remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you never miss an episode. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.